Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Carbon DeVito. My co-host Alice Creed couldn't make it today. She's sick and kind of has lost her voice. So I'm flying solo. Alice and I are the ladies of Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens in New York City and the surrounding area. And our show aims to bring the culture to horticulture. This season, this is our second to last show. Next Monday is our last show until the summertime, where we're going to have some specials. And then we come back in September. So we're glad that you guys are listening. Last week, we had a show on cultivated flowers, on cut flowers. And this week, we kind of do a 180-degree turn, and we turn to wildflowers, which is, I think, everybody loves. One of my personal favorite period films is Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette, starring Kirsten Dunst. I don't know if you guys know the film. Kirsten plays Queen Marie Antoinette, the 18th century monarch. And there's a great scene in the movie when the queen and her young daughter are walking in a meadow picking wildflowers, and they're wearing these simple white dresses, and the light is hitting them just right. And every time I see that scene, I think they sort of represent the essence of purity. And wildflowers, for me, represent that same simplicity and purity, as well as sort of the unexpected and spontaneous side of nature. Now, Alice and I have created many, many planned gardens and landscapes, and where we put a plant exactly where we want, and it generally stays there. It might spread, it might, you know, send its offspring around, but it stays in the same place that we put it. But my own experiences with wildflowers and what makes them so wonderful is how diverse and ephemeral they are. And my experiences with them have been ephemeral. I've encountered them on trails in the Colorados and the Rocky Mountain National Park. I've you know, picked wild fennel and field poppies in my grandfather's alfalfa field in Italy. And these are moments for me of pure joy and delight at finding this natural beauty in these unexpected places. So today's guest, Miriam Goldberger, has made wildflowers her life's work. And the story of her farm and her recently published book, Taming Wildflowers, is the subject of this week's show. But as we always do, before we introduce our guest, we're going to do the horticultural honor roll. Now, those of you that listen to us regularly, you've noticed that a lot of the people mentioned, a lot of people honored on the honor roll are often dead male botanists. But this week, we decided to go to do a 180-degree turn as well in this area. And we wanted to honor somebody who represented the sort of more humble and communal nature of wildflowers, as well as somebody who made a difference in the preservation of a small part of our wild heritage. So today we're going to honor a high school botany teacher. For many years, high school botany teachers from around Minnesota utilized this public park called Glenwood Park for field work with their students. They would ride the streetcar at the end of the line in the Bryn Mawr neighborhood, and the botany classes, they walked the rest of the way to the park to begin their collection of plant specimens. Doesn't that sound like an amazing high school experience? Eloise Butler, in particular, was well known for taking her Central and South high school students tromping through the bogs of Glenwood Park. Well, in 1907, Eloise Butler and three other Minneapolis high school botany teachers, Clara Levitt and Elizabeth Foss and Julia Clifford, organized a petition to persuade the Board of Park Commissioners to set aside land within Glenwood Park for a natural botanic garden. And this petition was signed by many other people, including university professors and local botanists. And the petition stated that a certain portion of the park grounds of Minneapolis be permanently set aside for a natural botanic garden for the introduction of students of botany and for the enjoyment of all lovers of nature. So the board was persuaded as to the value of preserving this wild habitat, and they approved the request. 3 acres of bog, meadow, and hillside were quickly fenced, and the Natural Botanical Garden opened on April 27th, 1907. Now, this is, you know, more than 100 years ago. This is what makes it most so extraordinary, because that part of the Midwest was still very much farmland. So this was extremely forward-thinking of them. Now, the botany teacher spent the first gardening season documenting all the species found within the Natural Botanic Garden's original 3 acres. Working as volunteers, the teachers visited their favorite botanizing locations to acquire more plants for the garden. These sites were sources for pitcher plants, yellow lady slipper, wild calla, posk flower, and many kinds of ferns which were transplanted into the garden. And during those early years, the garden was cared for solely by the botany teachers. They did the plant hunting, the transplanting, the weeding, the watering, and mulching, and they did that regularly. Upon her retirement from teaching, Eloise became the garden's first curator, and she continued to work in the garden until the ripe old age of 81. In fact, she had a heart attack in the garden while she was working on it. So that is an enormous amount of dedication. So today we honor Eloise Butler, and the garden has been named after her. It's the Eloise Butler Wildflower Garden, and it continues to provide thousands of urban dwellers in Minneapolis a taste of what the wild places of Minnesota used to look like. And she deserves high praise for her forward thinking and dedication to preserving that little bit of wilderness. So today we have another great lady. Our guest, as I said, is Miriam Goldberger. She's a plantswoman, a gardener, and an author and an expert on wildflowers. Her book has been praised by the likes of Ken Drews, Pete Udolph, and many others. She is the founder and co-owner of Wildflower Farm. It's a wildflower seed production company in Ontario, Canada. It's a magical 100 acres where the wildflower gardens and meadows thrive without irrigation or pesticides, self-described as a pollinator's paradise. Welcome, Miriam, to the show.
Hello there, Carmen. Really nice to be here.
Great. How is it up there? We still have quite a lot of snow on the ground here in New York.
Oh, I think we probably have more than you do, even though you guys have really seriously been slammed. But we're right up there. Yeah, I'm about an hour and a half north of Toronto, and this is ski country where Wildflower Farm is. So we know from snow.
So right now we just have to dream of wildflowers. We can't see any yet.
No. We this is the time when you know winter sowing, you know, is really getting underway. If you haven't done a dormant seeding already and all the planning that goes with traditional gardening, you know, you can plan away about your wildflowers now.
Yeah. Well, your book is wonderful. It was a great read. The first chapter in the book is titled, which I loved, is titled "How Wildflowers Changed My World: A Love Story." Can you tell us a little bit about the beginning? You kind of started out as a dancer, and then you founded a prenatal and postpartum fitness program in Toronto. How did you go from that to obsession with wildflowers? I love to share people's stories about that transformation of becoming a gardener.
Well, I really got into wildflowers in a very backward manner, and I am a completely self-taught horticulturalist, and at this point a native plant and sustainability horticulturalist, and I find it very funny that I now get to go out and talk to landscape architects and students and
isn't that great?
All kinds of experts about what I'm doing. But I think having been self-taught, has been an enormous advantage. But to answer your question, I think that there are so many parallels between the aesthetics of dance and garden design, because you're talking about color, space, and movement, and energy, and then my period of time as a childbirth educator, and even more briefly as a midwife, it really ties in so well too, because you know the incredible beauty of the miracle of birth over and over again, watching every single seedling come to life, never ceases to amaze me. I cannot get over how exciting that is. I love it. I love it. I love it. I love growing things from seed, and I've been doing that for, I don't know, 25, 28 years, something, some crazy amount of time. And blink. And the wildflower piece of it really came about quite accidentally, and originally I had a business relationship with wildflowers because they were expedient. I mean, I had this beautiful little bed in front of my little wildflower barn shop, it was pick your own at that time, and we also were involved with wholesale dried flower production, and I needed a garden that could take care of itself because I had acres of cutting gardens to deal with on my own primarily. My husband was still working full-time in the city in the advertising industry, and I had little kids, and I just needed something that would take care of itself. And so I thought, well, it has to be perennial, that much I knew. And then I started doing all this research, and indeed, I loved your introduction about Eloise Butler and her wildflower garden, because truly the resurgence of interest in native plants began in the Midwest, in Wisconsin, in
yes.
Minnesota, and I mean that's really where botanists and then gardeners fell in love with wildflowers all over again, and I put these plants that I grew from seed in this garden, and people started asking me over and over again, well, can you build me a garden like that? And I'd say, no. And they'd say, well, can you at least sell me the plants? And I'd say, no. And this went on for years until I got it through my rather dense skull that this would probably be a good idea. And eventually what ended up happening is we ended up devoting our entire business to wildflowers, and then we ended up developing this low maintenance lawn called Eco Lawn, which is also a sustainable garden and landscape idea. So the thing is, it was all backwards. It was completely backwards. And since I had a pick your own flower farm and I was doing all this floral design work, I thought I'd fool around with wildflowers and see if they actually made good cut flowers, and contrary to popular belief, they do.
Yeah, and that's what's amazing. I mean, you picked up, you said you had young children, you had three young children at the time, you left the city, you rented a 100-acre farm, mm-hmm. and you didn't have much experience, and you just did it.
Yeah,
and
that
I bet there must have been some. There must have been some interesting challenges those first few years as you tried to figure out how to go from, you know, no experience to making a business. How did you do it?
In hindsight, you know, it's just like so many entrepreneurial stories where you look back and you think, how could I have been possessed to do this? And in hindsight, it made no sense at all. But in terms of forward thinking and in terms of addressing and honoring my obsession with gardening, it made perfect sense. I mean, my husband regularly tells stories about how for many years I would awaken him in the middle of the night to talk about flowers.
And that's awesome.
I was growing every single kind of annual and perennial flower I could get my hands on, and I would grow them all from seed. When we got married, we didn't ask people to sign a gift registry. We asked people to contribute to the greenhouse fund, and that's how we got our first greenhouse.
That's amazing. You're 30 years ahead of the curve, because that's what people are doing now. you know, doing sort of the alternative.
I love, for example, being a part of the Association of Specialty Cut Flower Growers and the slow flower movement, because I love getting all these questions from people, and I love hearing all the issues that they're struggling with, because I can remember so well going through all those issues, and no, it wasn't easy.
No, I can't imagine.
But we had an amazing time doing it.
So, and your neighbors had some opinions about these city people coming out and farming. They even had, you know, they were wondering what you were, in your book you say that they were wondering why you were planting all these weeds in on all your acres. They even had a term for city people that came out. Didn't they call them cityots?
Yes, cityots. I think it's a great term. Yeah. Oh. Back in the day when we were first growing wildflowers, our first farm was right on this dirt road, and the farmers would stop on the dirt road, and they would laugh so hard they actually would fall off the tractors. They just couldn't understand it. And then we'd go into the little pub at night, and everybody was talking about how much they got per acre. And at that point, the traditional farming was, of course, plunging into financial despair. And we were growing a valuable perennial crops in terms of the wildflowers and the wildflower plants and seeds. And, they kind of stopped laughing after a while.
Yeah, and I bet some of them probably put some acres into production eventually, too, I would imagine.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, and of course, when you look today at issues of sustainability, for example, for a while, a lot of people were growing switchgrass, as a source of heat. And so there are so many applications, but that's of course a separate discussion.
Of course. Well, you give some you made the switch to native plants primarily, eventually, and I found it interesting that you gave some rather alarming statistics in your book about the effects of native plants being disturbed or eliminated due to overdevelopment. Can you share some of that data with our listeners?
Well, the simple fact, as most research has indicated, is that over 90% of wildflowers and native grasses have been wiped out in North America, and of that 90%, of that large amount of space, most of it now is lawn.
Yes,
it's lawn, and it's unsustainable, high maintenance, water guzzling, chemical guzzling, lawn that doesn't do anybody any good. And then there's about 20% of that area that is now plant material, and of that 20%, 20% is native plants. The rest of it is all alien or invasive plants that the pollinators, who we depend upon for sustenance for the food web, aka us getting to, human beings getting to eat, let alone everybody else that needs to survive and thrive on the entire planet, can't do without native plants. Native plants are really the driving force that keeps the wheels of ecosystems humming along.
Yeah, it was astounding, some of those stats. And in your book, you go into quite a bit of depth about our native bee species in particular. In fact, I was surprised to learn, for example, that most of our native bees don't make hives and are quite solitary. And you say that the native bees are actually less fussy pollinators than the European honeybee that we had imported, centuries ago. And the European honeybee is under enormous stress, and there's, the colony collapse disorder, and a lot of people are very concerned about the honeybee's decline. And the native bees can do the job of the honeybee.
Not only can they do the job, they do it far more efficiently, and they do it free of charge.
Yes.
Honeybees are an industry, and it's a wonderful industry, and I have many, many dear friends who are beekeepers, but it's an expensive industry.
Yes.
Aside from the issues of very dire issues of colony collapse and concerns for the cost of European bee pollination, is the fact that the native bees, the bumblebees, for example, are so much hardier and they're less wimpy. The European honeybees, I kind of think of them as the Jewish princesses of pollination, because you know they're always whining. It's too cold.
It's too hot.
Wet.
It's raining.
It's too hot. I'm not going out. You know, and
it's
and
raining.
So, I can't go out. It's too rainy.
So, yes. You know, I noticed that in my own garden. They only come out at certain hours of the day, you know, and I time my gardening around them.
Everything has to be just so, you know, like they want to ruin their nails.
Whereas the native bees are quite the opposite. And there's a lot of species of native bees that could pollinate not just our native plants, but also you're saying our crops.
Yep, and that's what's starting to happen. And it just makes a heck of a lot of sense. You know, plus the fact that wildflowers attract so many of the good bugs that keep agriculture humming along in a healthy way. And another thing that I want to throw in as far as design goes and planning in terms of native species is that all different types of pollinators, native and non-native, but especially the native ones, it's been proven now that they really prefer a more random, non-monoculture approach to the landscape. This is what works best, and it's interesting that meadows, of course, are a combination of wildflowers and native grasses, and they are seemingly random, but clearly for a specific bunch of purposes. And I'm not one of those people who ever says that everybody should only grow native plants.
I'm glad to hear you say that.
No. My philosophy of life is that there is no such thing as too many flowers. But what I am saying is that, and I'm not the first person to say this, you know, the marvelous botanist Doug Tallamy, you know, in his book Bringing Nature Home, it was the first scientist in a high profile manner to say that native plants are essential in the landscape. They need to be included in all kinds of landscapes, not just in meadows, but in community gardens, in urban gardens, in traditional flower borders, any kind of garden you got,
they can be incorporated.
They need to be incorporated, and it's really not much of a visual hardship because they really are so gorgeous.
Yes, well, Miriam, we have to take a break. Stay on the line. When we come back, we're going to go more into depth about the plants that you're growing, native and non-native, on We Dig Plants. Stay tuned.
You are listening to Sweet Talk by Pamela Royal, only on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Stay tuned for more from We Dig Plants.
In 2001, Heritage Foods USA has sold pasture-raised, antibiotic-free heritage meats to restaurants and homes around the country. Our farmers raise their animals with care using traditional methods guaranteed to produce the very best-tasting meat. Our pork breeds include Berkshire, Red Wattle, Duroc, Gloucester Old Spot, Large Black, and Tamworth. And our beef comes from Piedmontese, Angus Akiyushi, Belgian Blue, Highland, Simmental, and Belted Galloway cattle. We also carry a rotation of 24 rare breeds of heritage chicken, seasonal specialties like lamb, goat, geese, and of course, heritage turkeys. Visit us online at www.heritagefoodsusa.com or give us a call at 718-389-0985 to place your order today.
Hi, and welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We are here with wildflower grower and author Miriam Goldberger. She's a plantswoman and a lover of wildflowers. Her new book just came out, Taming Wildflowers. Miriam, let's get into some of the distinctions that you made in the book. Weeds, aliens, naturalized flowers. One man's weed is another man's wildflower, right? So how do you distinguish between those terms?
Well, there are some really simple distinctions. Most people these days, talking about wildflowers, they are talking about plants that were here before European settlement.
Okay.
So that means that there are a huge number of wildflowers, quote-unquote wildflowers, that aren't actually wildflowers, that are maybe wildflowers from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. All flowers are wildflowers originally from somewhere.
Sure.
And when you talk about heirloom plants, the way I think of heirloom plants, those are the plants that when our ancestors came over to North America, they brought with them the special seeds that helped them to survive and created beauty. You know, the vegetables, the flowers, and, mm-hmm. and those are heirlooms.
Yes.
And all the wildflowers that I am talking about are all open pollination, too. They're not clones or patented hybrid plants. They are plants that thrive within ecosystems and will live, generally speaking, for a very long time. Some of them have very deep roots. Some of them have very wide fibrous roots. It depends on the plant. You know, just like people, when you generalize, you get
yeah.
in trouble.
Yeah. So I know, I remember one of my favorite places to visit. My husband's from the Midwest. He's from Kansas originally. And I, before marrying him 20-plus years ago, I had never been west of the Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And when I went out to those prairies, Miriam, I was blown away, mm-hmm. blown away by the beauty of those native
Absolutely.
Plants. And there's not a lot of prairie left. And of course, one of the first things I did was bring back a bunch of seeds of native plants, which I tried to grow. And I want to ask you about this because I tried to grow them from seed and I wasn't very successful. And I know that some of it had to do with my New Yorker Northeast impatience. I definitely contributed to that. Because I'm a pretty good gardener. And so I had a lot of challenges, and I'd love for you to talk about, clarify some of the different ways that some of these seeds have to be prepared prior to planting. Because some of them, they're tough plants and they're easy to grow, but getting them started sometimes can be a little bit challenging. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, basically, Carmen, most wildflowers that I am talking about in my book, Taming Wildflowers, simply require winter sowing or cold, moist stratification. And
that's where I got into trouble, the cold, moist stratification.
Yeah. Yeah, cold, moist stratification really just means fooling certain seeds into thinking they've gone through winter. And the process of freeze and thaw and freeze and thaw and freeze and thaw, that happens at the end of winter, you know, when the weather is deciding, is it going to be cold today? Is it going
yeah.
to be warmer today? That is the process that actually compromises the wildflower seed shells, and then they start opening up. And nature has programmed them to need to go through those phases of freeze-thaw after a period of coldness. And that's what opens up the seed. And not all wildflowers require that. There are some easier wildflowers too, but it's not a hard thing to do. You can do it in the refrigerator. You can throw some wildflower seeds in a pot, cover them like an eighth of an inch, press down on the pot, put them outside for the winter, and then when things warm up, get going with growing them. And it's actually not a difficult process. It's like wildflower gardening in general. It's not difficult. It's just different.
Right. So people have to kind of make an adjustment in how they garden. You give a detailed description of each flower in the book, I think 60 or 70 species, and also pretty detailed cultural instructions. And you also include, which I found really interesting and unusual, you include pollination partners for each flower, which I thought was great. So if somebody wants to attract a particular insect or pollinator, you know, or even songbird to their garden, they can kind of go through the book and, you know, kind of pick the flowers that way. And of course, looking at the conditions as well. You must have done a lot of research to include that information, or is this more from your own observation in working in the gardens and planting?
It's really a combination. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been observing what's going on in the wildflower garden for many, many years, and it's fun because I'm always learning. But it's just so fascinating to, for example, I'll give you a specific example, the baptisias or the...
Oh, I love those.
The blue false indigos, the white false indigos, the yellow false indigos, for example. Every single spring, the bumblebees just have a heyday.
Yeah.
On the baptisias, and they do this little dance, you know, where they stick their heads in to pry open the buds so they can get the pollen
first.
And they're, you know, I wish for a moment it wasn't radio, because when I do talks, I love doing the bumblebee dance, you know. You basically just move your butt back and forth, and that's what they do, you know. Just sort of, they mightily open up in there, and early on in the spring, it's the queen bumblebees, and later on, it's the workers. But I mean, it's a fascinating world because there are so many stories of interaction that happen. You know, a lot of people love the monarchs; they're a great example, and all the milkweed family, the Asclepias, you know, are the essential food for the monarchs. Whether you're talking about the eggs being laid, whether you're talking about the caterpillars, or you're talking about a full-grown monarch, every single phase of a monarch's life is intimately connected and dependent upon milkweeds. And milkweed actually produces horrible
sap
poison. That any kind of monarch predator really avoids, literally like the plague. And so, you know, there's all these systems in place that have evolved, co-evolved for, gosh, tens of thousands of years. And it's a pretty great system. And so I really wanted people to be aware of that when I talked about the plants. And I really tried with this book to give people a lot of unusual but really useful information, like pictures of the seedlings, the wildflower seedlings.
Yes, yes.
When you're trying to weed in the spring, who knows what's what? And now you can know what's what.
No, that's what I found so great about the book too, is that pollinator information, the picture of the seedling, which many times looks radically different than a full-grown plant. You know, Alice and I make lots of gardens, and, you know, sometimes, strangely, some people ask us, Miriam, I want flowers, but I don't want any bees. They have actually asked us that. Make sure you plant flowers that don't attract bees. And that's quite a challenge, you know, to accomplish. And we try to include native plants and hardy plants in, you know, almost every garden that we make. But it requires an adjustment, and sometimes you can't convince people. And what I read in your book, when you said that you spend only about an hour a year maintaining your own wildflower garden, that really struck a chord with me, because it's such a different kind of garden than the kind of gardens that we make that require a lot more maintenance, you know, the typical traditional European style gardening. So what is it about the meadow and the wildflower garden that makes it so low maintenance?
Well, before I answer your question, I will add to your comment, which is that you can actually create very formal gardens with wildflowers, and do it in such a way where you are still getting all the benefits that the wildflowers provide, but you have a very different look visually, a very formal look, and that's really easy to do. Or if you put a traditional border around a very wild informal area, or a shrub, or our low maintenance turf grass eco lawn, any of those things as a frame. I mean, this is a wonderful technique that Pete Udolph uses all the time.
Yes.
Where you have the contrast, the delicious contrast of highly wild informality juxtaposed with the formality. But to answer your question, the beauty in terms of low maintenance that a wildflower style garden or meadow provides is that it's a combination of wildflowers and native grasses, and the wildflowers tend to have more vertical roots that go down a variety of different lengths, and then the native grasses have wide fibrous roots. And in nature, in a meadow, nature tends to plant plants about one plant per square foot, which is a heck of a lot closer than European high maintenance style.
Yes, exactly.
But what that means, of course, is that you're retaining water, so you don't need to be watering. The young plants are sheltered by the older plants, so they have a chance to mature. And this type of garden or meadow is one that once established, really, it requires, well, at no point does it require watering or fertilizing, and deadheading isn't important at all in this type of situation. Although I will confess to deadheading Coreopsis and Galardia, so they'll bloom throughout the season.
Yeah, you know, some require that.
I'm not above it. Sure, so I'm not above it.
No. To get more flowers, we don't mind.
Absolutely.
So you're saying that after you plant, after you make the meadow, whether it's from plugs or plantings or seed, it is like dry land farming. Whatever rain comes once it's, or do you water a little bit and weed while they're getting established?
For the most part, you're not needing to water, because this type of gardening is very site specific.
Okay.
You know, it's the old right plant in the right place kind of thing. For example, we offer lots of different types of meadow mixes, and there's one called the Clay Buster, and it's all wildflowers that thrive in pure unamended clay, and never do you need to water that. And the same thing with a dry soils meadow mix; you just don't need to water. And these plants have been on the planet for thousands and thousands of years without any human intervention or assistance, and they've survived floods and droughts and heat waves and hurricanes and tornadoes, and they're fine. Thanks very much.
Exactly. So what do you think the biggest mistake is that people make when they, you know, get seed mixes and you know, fail? What are they doing wrong, do you think?
Most of the time, what that really means is that they've bought a bag of seeds or a can of seeds or a pack of seeds that has a pretty picture on it that actually is not truly wildflowers and native grasses. Most commercially available meadow mixes tend to be a lot of fill and chaff, a lot of European annuals and invasive plants, and they rarely, if ever, include true perennial North American native grasses. So it's bound to fail.
Wow.
The thing is, the process of creating a meadow is not a difficult one. It is simply a different one.
So your mixes, you sell plants as well as seed mixes, right, Miriam?
Not at this point, Carmen.
Just seeds.
For 25 years, we grew lots of plants, and we still do some custom growing, mm-hmm. but we actually decided that it would be really interesting to explore this concept that most people are very familiar with called a weekend.
Yes.
So we decided to get a life and not grow thousands and thousands of plants and not be open to the public in the same kinds of ways. And it's really quite curious because it's actually very pleasant. And it allowed me the opportunity to write this book, for example.
Right. So you're selling seed now exclusively, mm-hmm. right?
We sell seeds all over North America, individual types of wildflower seeds, as well as meadow mixes, and as I said, our eco lawn, yeah.
Okay. But you also, and I would be remiss if I didn't include, you also are still doing wildflower weddings. Is that right, Miriam?
I do
selectively
some design work, and I okay. consult, and I am definitely still very involved with the design community. We spent many, many years doing very elaborate wildflower weddings, and it's not something that I do on a regular basis.
Right.
But it is, I'm involved, oh yes.
And you still have your, do people still come and pick their own flowers, or that no longer that, is that something that you still offer to the public locally?
It is by appointment.
Okay.
Yeah, and I do get involved with working with individuals on weddings and other types of projects. But again, I'm very, very careful at this point in my life, having
right.
done it 7 days a week, literally
oh, yeah.
for 25 years.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Alice and I, a number of years ago, had a good friend and gardener who got married in Santa Fe, and we went to the wedding because we had never been, and another good friend who lived in Santa Fe and was a gardener, we recommended him to do the flowers. He had been a gardener and a floral designer in New York for many, many years,
wonderful.
And part of the deal was that we were going to go pick wildflowers in the desert and incorporate them into the bouquet, which was one of the most wonderful experiences. I think some of the people driving down the road thought we were kind of crazy because it was July in the mm-hmm. desert, but we made the most amazing bouquets from, you know, the native mm-hmm. plants that and wildflowers that were mm-hmm. growing there. So it really, I think it's one of the, you have some wonderful photos in the book and also on your website and instructions for people to sort of make their own bouquets and boutonnieres mm-hmm. and all mm-hmm. the other accoutrements that go with flowers, you know, with weddings.
Absolutely. I think the more, I've always believed that the more I can empower people to understand that they have the creative abilities and as they're working and learning the plants, they come to a real understanding and a real reverence for these beautiful flowers and so they really end up with something that lasts far past their wedding. They really have a closeness with the wildflowers that are in their own geography, and it's pretty exciting that's happening.
Exactly, and a bride that is making her own bouquet a couple of days before the wedding with her family and friends, it's such a very different experience than just going to a florist many months in advance, picking flowers that have come from, you know, hundreds if not thousands of miles away.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's
that
just
a lot of chemicals on them.
Oh, I know uh-huh. that too. We just last week we had Deborah Prinzing on talking about the slow flower movement. It's really
absolutely.
It's yes. gratifying to hear that you're part of that as well. Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, the 45 minutes has gone very, very quickly. Miriam, would you like to give your website and other contact information for our listeners to follow you and to hopefully buy some seed and your book from you this season?
I would love to. It's really pretty simple. The book website is tamingwildflowers.com. My wildflower farm website is wildflowerfarm.com. I'm all over Facebook by the name Miriam Goldberger, and then there's a Wildflower Farm Facebook page, a Taming Wildflowers Facebook page. I'm on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Miriam Wild FLR. That's Miriam Wild FLR. I'm on Instagram and I'm on Pinterest. I'm everywhere.
Well, I'm so glad that you could take the time to be on our show today. Thank you so much. I look forward to keeping in touch virtually, and of course, if I ever in the Toronto, Ontario area, I'm going to call you and get a tour of your farm.
That would be absolutely wonderful. I would love to show you around, Carmen. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Special thanks go out to our sponsor. The show has been produced by Jack Inslee and engineered by Joe G. Please remember to join our Facebook fan page. We only have two more shows left in this season to stay current on our projects and our upcoming shows. And you can also win free stuff. Thank you for listening and see you in the garden.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.